From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In the first half hour today, we talk cybercrime with Des Moines attorney Trey Critelli and Brian Burkhart, director of the Electronic Crime Institute at the Des Moines Area Community College. Tomorrow, Saturday, DMACC will host a free conference to help consumers lower their risk for identity theft and increase their internet safety awareness. Then in the second half hour, Matt Shinkevich, an Emmy-nominated screenwriter and documentarian. Shinkevich has addressed issues of racial and ethnic stereotyping in the long-running series South Park. He's speaking next week at the University of Northern Iowa. That's all coming up, but first, a look at this hour's news. So glad you could be with us over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Frequently, we hear in the news how criminals are using a lot of sophisticated techniques, technology, to steal identities and personal information. Just last week, the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission reported a serious breach of its security. The commission regulates gambling at racetracks and on boats. And according to a story published this week in the Des Moines Register, the personal information of about 80,000 people, yes, 80,000, and these are names, social security numbers, home addresses, and dates of birth, was breached from a licensing database housed on a computer system operated by the commission. A forensic analysis of the breach pinpointed China as the probable origin. It's only the latest evidence that thieves in China, around the world, and of course in this country too, are on a mission to steal information and money from us. Well, the Electronic Crime Institute at the Des Moines Area Community College wants to help stop this trend. So tomorrow, the Institute, in conjunction with the Des Moines chapter of the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, will host a free 3-hour conference to help consumers lower their risk for identity theft and increase their internet safety awareness. The Protecting Yourself from Fraud and Identity Theft Conference will be tomorrow, Saturday, from 9 to noon. That's at the DMACC Ankeny campus. The Electronic Crime Institute at DMACC is the first of its kind in the nation, and it's geared to educating students and the public to help fighting cybercrime, cyberterrorism. It was back in 2008 that DMACC received $1.7 million in federal appropriations to establish this new crime-fighting educational institute. Joining me now, the director of the Electronic Crime Institute, Brian Burkhart. He's in our studios at in Des Moines of Iowa Public Radio. Brian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Ben. It's great to be here to visit with you.
Very good. Sitting close to you, Des Moines attorney Trey Critelli. Trey is a certified fraud examiner. I understand the only lawyer in Iowa with such a certification. Good afternoon to you, Trey.
Good afternoon.
I want to talk about the cybercrime in the news, but let's focus on the conference first of all. Brian, how do you hope this conference will help in the fight against electronic crime and fraud?
Well, Ben, you already began our discussion today by prefacing how the Electronic Crime Institute came to be. And certainly one of our major goals is public outreach and making sure that the general public is aware of safety, of ways that they can prevent themselves from being taken advantage of during cybercrime. And so the ultimate goal for us then would be in tomorrow's conference to make sure that folks are more aware of what they should or shouldn't be doing, remaining more vigilant so that they don't become a victim of this type of crime.
And this conference is open to all types, anybody who wants to come, and they can come to show up tomorrow, right?
Absolutely. Walk-ins are certainly welcome. We've got a pre-registration process already in place on our website. However, you certainly can just walk right in to Building 7 there on the Ankeny campus, and we'd be happy to have you.
Your institute hasn't been around that long, but how are we doing? Is there still a lot of ignorance out there, naivete? It seems every other day I'm offered $1 million from someone in Ghana, and I'm just wondering how many people out there are going for those things still?
Well, the fact of the matter is they wouldn't still do them if people weren't falling for it, quite frankly. And it really is just human nature for us to want something too good to be true. And sadly, folks are still being taken advantage of it, whether it's phishing schemes on email or whether it's folks being kind of cold called, so to speak, and being pressed into giving critical and personal information in that regard, too. Are we making progress? Sure, we're shutting some of those organizations down as best we can. can, especially those domestically based. However, there's always folks out there looking to get our money or somehow swindle us, and certainly there's more coming every day.
Give us a menu. What are for you are the greatest concerns in the realm of electronic crime at present?
Well, certainly one of the things that we always have to watch out for are white-collar crimes such as fraud and identity theft. But certainly we also need to continue to watch out for child exploitation and child pornography, manufacture and distribution. That's something that transcends the globe. We also need to look at other types of crimes, including intellectual property, copyright, etc.
Trey Critelli, give me a good example of fraud that takes place in our electronic world.
Well, probably the classic example is getting the email that may come in. And a lot of them obviously are a bit, I won't use the word ludicrous, but certainly out there, Nigerian princes, things of that sort. But you get a lot more email that comes in that looks on its face to be very reputable. I know there's a fraud being perpetrated upon the lawyers across the country dealing with their trust accounts. And this is something I've traveled the state speaking to law firms about. And what happens there is a law firm will get an email from a potential client saying, we wish to bring a lawsuit against an Iowa corporation. And when the lawyer goes online, they look and find that it is, in fact, a true Iowa corporation. And the issuing company, that is the company that the email came out of, is, in fact, a true company, we'll say, in China. So doing all the normal due diligence indicates that this is, in fact, a legitimate dispute. But really it's not, because the person who sent the email is pretending to be a legitimate company. Mm-hmm. And these problems are not only targeting individuals but also businesses. And that's a major sector that I think people overlook
in that firms. In that instance, take us further down the trail. Then what happens after that to the person?
Oftentimes what will happen is a law firm will be engaged, and then a couple of weeks later they'll get an email or a fax transmission that will say, hold off, don't sue anybody. We've got a settlement, and a law firm will then get a cashier's check, primarily issued out on a bank out of Canada for, you know, $200,000-$400,000. The attorney's asked to deposit it into their trust account, and then wire transfer 2/3 out to the client and keep a third for their time. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, a couple of weeks down the road, the Canadian bank says it's a fraudulent cashier's check, and now the attorney is out a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any idea of estimating how much is lost to this type of fraud in Iowa?
I've never seen statistics specific to Iowa on this type of fraud. I know generally the FTC has said about 9 million people have identity theft issues each year, and the cost of ranked in the billions. One of the difficulties is there's really no actual way of finding out how many people have been taken. Many people are embarrassed. On the smaller, you know, $1,000 fraud, they may not say anything to anyone. And also, practically speaking, there's not much recourse. There's not a lot you can do to ever get the money back. These folks are outside of our jurisdiction.
Is there a certain demographic that these people prey on? The elderly, for example.
Well, I'll take that one, Ben. I really do believe that certainly they'll prey on anyone who believes that there's the off chance that they could get lucky or get rich for doing very little. Let's put it that way. So certainly anyone who doesn't remain vigilant, it doesn't matter the age. In fact, sadly, one of the increasing age ranges for identity theft is actually children because they have pristine credit. And so there are actually people who are assuming those types of identities, at least through their Social Security numbers, to try to obtain credit in their names.
I guess it wasn't meaning the elderly because they could be easily duped, but because they have accumulated wealth. That would be a nice pot of gold for someone to be after. I'd like to reach out to our listeners and ask you to join our conversation. Perhaps you have been the target of a stolen identity or a victim of fraud. What worries you most about exchanging information, conducting business on the Internet? Ask your question now, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. At the outset, I mentioned the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission reporting this serious breach, 80,000, the data from 80,000 people now pinpointed as somewhere in China they had created this breach. Where does this breach reported by the Iowa Gaming Commission and its link to China seem to fit into the wider context of cyber crime and cyber terrorism?
Well, I certainly think that we need to always be cautious about where we pinpoint the source of this type of crime. Now, I don't know the specific details of this incident. However, it's often very easy for us to point toward our enemies, whatever they may be, or suspected enemies, and say that they're the culprits here. It also, though, I can attest, is very easy to make it look like it's coming from one of our so-called enemies. And so that's following that actual footprint becomes a little more difficult, depending on how good the criminal is. Certainly, it'd be very easy for someone to infiltrate a Chinese computer and then correspond or try to seize that information, appearing as if it came from China, too. So that's one of the difficult things that we need to look at. We certainly need to be just as vigilant globally, but we also need to look within our own backyard, so to speak. There's lots of folks who see and the value of that type of information and what it could provide both domestically as well as globally.
Let's go to our first caller. Brian is calling from Eldridge. Good afternoon, Brian. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Pardon me.
We're just into the afternoon. Yes. Go ahead, Brian.
I had an experience of fraud. It was very minor. It only involved about a $15 charge. But what happened was my phone bill suddenly had this extra $15 on it. And I called them. They traced it. And it was hooked up to a website for opening voicemail accounts, and all you had to enter in was a name and an address. And even though they never found out who did this, basically someone just randomly, I assume, out of the phone book, picked my name and address, opened their account, and the bills started showing up on my phone bill. And the phone company took care of it, and they were trying to find a way to block these things, but they claim that there are just thousands of them out there where there's no security on the website to prevent anyone from doing what, you know, happened to me.
Brian, we have about a minute before the break. Let's get a response from Brian or Trey to this minor fraud, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, Brian raises a good issue. One of the ways to detect fraud is to look at your statements, be it credit card statements. In this case, it was a telephone statement, because many frauds get put on in exactly this way. It's not a situation where your license is being taken, but someone is using your identity to gain something. So reviewing your statements is one of the classic ways of detecting fraud. And unfortunately, this happens all the time.
Okay. We have to take a short break. Trey Critelli with us, certified fraud examiner, Des Moines attorney. Brian Burkhardt, director of the Electronic Crime Institute at the Des Moines Area Community College. We'll be back in just a moment. When we come back, I want to address the question that a lot of us have. An anonymous email poses the question, should you pay your bills through the mail, good old-fashioned snail mail, or is it okay to pay them online? Do you still have problems paying bills online? Should you be worried about it? What should you watch out for? We'll address that question when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Protecting Yourself from Fraud and Identity Theft Conference will be tomorrow from 9 a.m. to noon. That's at the DMAC Ankeny campus. We're talking today with the director of its Electronic Crime Institute, Brian Burkhardt. Trey Critelli with us, Des Moines attorney and certified fraud examiner. Just a few minutes left. We want to get to a number of calls, but let's go to this question of paying bills. The anonymous emailer wants to know, do studies show one method safer or more secure than the other, paying online versus putting your check in the mail?
I'll take that one. This is Brian. I think that actually you have very little to worry about when it comes to paying bills online. Most of the mechanisms that we have in place now with those that are receiving our payments have instituted excellent security practices. In many cases, they are working with financial institutions to have multiple actual identity or authentication methods to be able to pay those. And that certainly helps us out. It's just as easy for someone to actually come in and steal a check out of a mailbox, so to speak. In fact, it'd be easier to do that than it would to physically wiretap, so to speak, your electronic comment. Trey has something to add. Yeah,
and I'll agree with Brian. As long as you access your bank's account through your bank site and not through an email you receive from your bank. One of the classic ways of phishing, that is, of getting information, is to send you an email from your bank saying, click here to be logged into your such and such bank account. And if you do that, there's a good likelihood that your account information will be compromised. So if you go to your bank's website and you make sure that that is the bank's website and you log in, for the most part, you're going to be safe and have no problems.
Trey, the conference will include presentations about Ponzi and pyramid schemes, recently, of course, causing financial ruin for thousands of people across the country. Bernard Madoff, you will present, help lead this discussion. What points do you want to drive home about Ponzi schemes?
What we're going to talk a little bit about with the attendees is just what is the difference between Ponzi schemes and pyramid schemes. These are terms that we hear a lot that are used. Essentially, with the Ponzi scheme is money is being taken from one person and being paid to another. And I thought I'd go a little bit into just kind of where they came from. The Ponzi scheme is named after an individual. It's the only crime named after a person, which is maybe a bit of infamy there. But we're going to talk a little bit about what they are, because fraud is a real general area, and even identity theft itself is very general. There's many ways that identities can be stolen, and there's many ways to commit fraud. Fraud oftentimes is alleged when someone goes to buy or sell a house. If they don't disclose that there's water in the basement, that could be considered a species of fraud, as well as the Ponzi schemes and the things we read about in the paper. So we're going to cover a lot of the background of fraud, where it came from, and it basically comes out of the concept of deceit, to deceive someone, to get something for yourself.
Okay, let's go to our next caller, Andrew, calling from Johnson. Hi, Andrew.
Yes, how do you do, sir? The same thing that you're talking about, especially what hit the gambling casinos in Iowa, was very similar to what happened to the Bet Costa Rica International Sports in Costa Rica. Exactly the same stuff. They were hacked by hackers from a different country. And they then started getting mail from the hackers that they're supposed to pay off so many thousands of dollars and they'd be off their list for a while. And then after that, they'd come back and raise their stakes. They had to get somebody to finally start helping them out because they were flooded.
Mm-hmm.
And the person that was called was a guy by the name of Joseph Mann, J-O-S-E-P-H-M-E-N-N. Have you heard of him?
Well, let's get a response about gambling and fraud, perhaps in Iowa. Are there any connections there that we've come across, either Brian or Trey?
I do not know of any specific, or at least our research hasn't indicated any specific types of fraud with regard to gambling. I know the federal government, though, has implemented some strong limitations on those who are embarking on online gambling and the ways that they can pay for that, including the exclusion of payment via credit card. For that type of purpose.
Social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter have become more and more popular, not just with younger people, but with adults. Are there cyber crimes connected with the emerging social networking sites?
Absolutely, Ben. One of the things that comes to mind, I actually had a good friend of mine just to relay about 2 weeks ago that he logged into his Facebook account midst of a Facebook chat or an instant messaging chat going on with one of his friends, so to speak. He obviously was not the one who instigated this chat, and this chat transcript indicated that he needed $1,000 wired to him right away. So we're seeing some of these what we would consider traditional methods of trying to get money, wire fraud, etc., now moving into that social networking, one more means to be able to do that. But certainly other types of cybercrime as well, from stalking to harassment, things along those lines are also very much a reality in social networking environments.
Is there a list you can quickly run through that's maybe easy to remember, or just the basic do's and don'ts when it comes to living in the cyber world to prevent crime happening to you?
Well, I'm going to get the list started, and then Trey can certainly add to it as well. The first thing that I would say is be vigilant. If something sounds too good to be true, whether you receive it via email or whether you receive it via fax or even by snail mail, postage mail, the fact of the matter is that you need to be cautious of it. The next thing that I'd say, though, specifically to online, is make sure that you are employing the appropriate security measures to your computer, that you're diversifying your passwords, and the other the last thing I'd add to my list before I turn over to Trey is we do need to make sure that you inspect your credit report on a regular basis. The fact is that we can catch a lot of these types of things, yes, by reviewing our bank statements or by reviewing our telephone statements, but the fact is a lot of people who are victims of identity theft don't know they are victims until it comes time for them to take out a loan or try to pursue additional credit on their own, and sadly it's too late at that point.
Yeah, quickly, so it's quickly, what would be a red flag on the credit report?
Well, obviously, a very low credit score is one. A lot of outstanding credit.
I could interrupt here. One of the classic ones would be you log in and check your credit report using, by the way, annualcreditreport.com. That's the free version, annualcreditreport.com.
Mm-hmm.
And you review that, and maybe you find that you've opened up three or four credit cards that you never even knew you had.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're listed as having your residence someplace in a different state that you've never lived. These are the type of flaws that you see on credit reports. Some of them are innocent. There are mistakes. But oftentimes, that may be the first indication that you get that someone is using your identity. Because keep in mind, if I'm the bad person and I get a credit card in your name, I may be paying my bills.
Mm-hmm.
And you may never actually get a statement. And so I would run that up and I'm using it, and then I make a big purchase and then I don't pay. And the only time you find out about your credit's been compromised is when the collectors come after you.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, hey, how come you're not paying your Visa bill? And you'll say, I don't have a Visa card. And by gosh, you do.
And then the story starts there. Over a minute left. I'd like to wind up with this. The White House Director of National Intelligence, Dennis Blair, on Tuesday appeared before a Senate panel to deliver the annual threat assessment of the U.S. intelligence community, said the U.S. is severely under the threat of great cyber attacks, all kinds of adversaries, other nations, terrorist networks, organized crime. How does the Electronic Crime Institute at DMACC fit into this challenge, Brian Burkhart?
Well, first of all, this is exactly why the Electronic Crime Institute is in place at Des Moines Area Community College. We received congressionally mandated funding, thanks in large part to Representative Tom Latham, just for this reason. We provide both in a credit and non-credit setting courses for those who either want to investigate these types of electronic crime and computer security, or and certainly those who just need to know more about it. So we actually provide training opportunities for law enforcement, for corporate entities mm-hmm. who employ this, as well as the general public, like our conference tomorrow.
Okay, but why choose a community college in Iowa to be the site of this unique Electronic Crime Institute?
One of the aspects for us is we are centrally located, but also community colleges in the state of Iowa generally have been able to turn on a dime, so to speak, to be responsive to the critical needs of a lot of these different entities. And certainly we're known for our continuing education and outreach opportunities for the general public.
Okay, I want to remind our listeners, the Protecting Yourself from Fraud and Identity Theft Conference will be tomorrow, Saturday. That's the 6th of February from 9 to noon at the DMACC Ankeny campus. Registration begins at 8:30. You can just show up on the day. And I want to thank you, Brian Burkhart, Director of the Electronic Crime Institute at Des Moines Area Community College. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Trey Critelli, Certified Fraud Examiner and Des Moines Attorney, for stopping by as well.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, a conversation with Emmy-nominated screenwriter and documentarian Matt Shinkevich. He'll tell us about issues of race and ethnic stereotyping in the long-running series South Park. Shinkevich is speaking next week at the University of Northern Iowa. We'll be back in just a minute. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Next week, the University of Northern Iowa will host a series of events featuring Emmy-nominated screenwriter and documentarian Matt Shinkevich. Shinkevich is a PhD candidate at the University of Wisconsin. Shinkevich has spoken and written on issues of racial and ethnic stereotyping in the long-running Comedy Central cartoon South Park. He will share his thoughts on these issues next week at UNI. I spoke with Matt Shinkevich yesterday. Matt, much of your talk will focus on South Park and its anti-Semitic slurs, the other slurs, various sorts in it. For those not acquainted with South Park, give us a picture of the type of slurs featured in the show and what sets it apart from more conventional comedy.
In my presentation, the way that I like to critically approach South Park, I do like to distinguish between sort of two ways in which the show invokes what we'd call insensitive humor, offensive humor, particularly aimed at ethnic groups, religious groups, and other sorts of minorities. And on the one hand, there are just sort of off-the-cuff remarks where the Jewish character will walk into the room, and the character Cartman, who is sort of the town anti-Semite, will come up and just say, "Hey, Jew," or "What are you doing here, Jew," or something along those lines, sort of just kind of tossed off. And then there's sort of a more complicated, more interesting approach to this sort of controversial humor that the show uses, where they'll have storylines that seem to be based on. To a certain extent, based on anti-Semitic stereotypes, based on racial stereotypes about African Americans, but in the overall scope of the show, sort of proved to be a satiric point or a comment on some other element of society. So, on the one hand, you have sort of the use of vulgar language, the use of sort of words that we're used to calling offensive, and on the other hand, we have storylines which are a little bit more involved, but. Also kind of invoke a lot of these really uncomfortable ideas, uncomfortable words, and uncomfortable jokes.
Mm-hmm. So whether it is one of these two types, the off-the-cuff sort or the more the thought-out storyline, mm-hmm. the overall goal of the creators, the producers of this program, you think is what?
I hesitate to ascribe too much to our ability to get in the head of these guys, Parker and Stone, who create the show. However, I think if you take a close look at the program, you can get some ideas as to what their strategies are. And just like those two examples of those two genres of offensive humor that I pointed out are in the show, I think you can see sort of two parallel goals, parallel strategies that they're using. And on the one hand, it is, as you might suspect, to shock, to appall, to push the envelope, to perhaps, if you think about it industrially, to create what's known as edge, a program where, certain people are going to find it hip and cool and exciting, and other people who they don't want to watch anyway, who aren't their advertising targets, the older people, whatever it might be, won't watch it. But there also is I think, a much more important thing going on when they're doing this, and that they're trying to get us to think about the ways that we talk about race, the ways that we talk about anti-Semitism. And I think it's almost uncomfortable the way when I watch an episode of South Park, I hear moments which I think are just there to shock and appall, but then I see a storyline which is about anti-Semitism, which might seem on the surface almost anti-Semitic. But when I look at it a little bit deeper, I see them trying to, trying to get the viewers to think about the ways that we talk about inter-religious struggle in America, the way we talk about race relations, in a much more sophisticated way, and it's that balance that can be off-putting at times.
Mm-hmm. Can you bring to mind an episode or an instance of what you just spoke of, mm-hmm. an example that would be, of course, appropriate for our radio?
Right, of course. Well, one episode that I'm going to focus on during my presentation this week is the episode "The Passion of the Jew." In this episode, the town of South Fork sort of breaks down into two camps. One in favor of Mel Gibson's movie The Passion of the Christ, and these tend to be the Christians who are in favor of it, and the Jewish population, which is against it, which sees it as perpetuating Jewish stereotypes and so on and so forth. And if you watch the episode on a really kind of surface level, what you'll see is an angry Jewish mob kind of against a running up against this really kind of maybe not ignorant but certainly less than fully enlightened Christian group. The Christian group is blindly in favor of Gibson's film, and the Jewish group is just sort of blindly against everything, sort of irrationally acting. And if you look at it, you see sort of these, in some ways, Jewish stereotypes. This sort of mob of people who are trying to control the media, trying to shut down a film they don't like. And on the surface, you could be offended by it. But I think if you put the show back in context, you realize that when it first aired, it was right at the height of the debate over The Passion of the Christ. And if you look at the sort of the stuff that was in the news at that time, and you realize that they're not so much making fun of Jews, making fun of Christians, they're making fun of the way this debate was taking place. They're making fun of the way that Abe Foxman of the Anti-Defamation League started comparing the Passion of the Christ to Kristallnacht and things leading up to the Holocaust. And the way that Mel Gibson, the producer of the film, would go on talking about how God was his co-writer in the project. And what they're really getting at is that the discourse, the way we were talking about anti-Semitism. The way we were talking about this film and the relationship between Christians and Jews was not healthy. It was a screaming match, and so their characters develop into the screaming match, and that's how I read it, at least.
Mm-hmm. So the creators, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, want us to arrive in our thinking at a certain point, which is, it's all just ridiculous, or is it more than that?
I think it's a little bit more than that. I think that they want us to look at it and say that there is a debate to be had, but the way that we're having it is not appropriate. It's not a way that's respectful to one another. It's not a way that it shows sort of a sophistication. And that's why they reduce these characters to stereotypes. I think what they're saying is that sort of the public personas of the people who are on the, you know, the sort of the TV pundits, the advocacy people in this, are not sort of taking a step back and being self-critical at all. That they're just sort of taking up a stereotypical position and advancing it so far as it can get them on TV, or so far as it can advance sort of a very narrow goal without thinking of the broader picture. I don't think it's nihilistic. I think that deep down it is arguing that there's a way that we can discuss things like anti-Semitism and a very, you know, and race relations and all these things in a really productive way. But the way it is done over the media, the way it's done on cable news, the way it's done over, you know, internet blogs or whatever the case may be, often is self-parodying. So they're kind of just perpetuating that. They're sort of pointing out the ways that people, in order to make their points, reduce themselves to stereotypes.
Do you think that, let's assume that that's the intent that Trey Parker and Matt Stone have here, do you think that the majority of the viewers arrive at this point? I see so many people with, you know, reacting to these stereotypes viscerally, or the vulgar parts of it, just not getting past the shock and appalling
right.
part of it, right?
Absolutely. There's no way of really accurately gauging what people are getting out of a program. And I'm certainly not here to advocate a right and a wrong way to view a show. I'm not one who believes that your job as a viewer is to figure out exactly what the creator wants you to get out of it and get that out of it. You know, if your reaction is visceral, if you simply think there's no excuse for using these stereotypes, that no matter how much you're going to look into it deeper, on the surface, it's just a turnoff. I mean, I would be the last person to tell you not to feel that way. The question is how many people are reacting one way or another. I mean, again, it's hard to tell for sure, but I'm not, you know, I hesitate to praise the show uniformly for its ability for a certain viewer to get something very positive out of it, just as I hesitate to condemn it for putting out the possibility that that you could get something very negative out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, I'm really speaking more about that second category of sort of offensive humor. When I say that, I'm far less sympathetic to the sort of off-the-cut, what I'd call kind of a casual racism, a casual anti-Semitism that you see.
Mm-hmm.
That I have less trouble finding a reason to make that feel less than being there for shock value, less than being there for sort of a it's hard not to be cynical with it, that it's a way to sort of appeal to a certain demographic which wants to see buttons pushed and wants to see you know, taboos assaulted, maybe not for any productive reason.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Matt Shinkayevich, an Emmy-nominated screenwriter and documentarian. Shinkayevich has spoken and written on issues of racial and ethnic stereotyping in the long-running comedy Central cartoon South Park. I wonder if you concern yourself, Matt, with the perspective of parents, and there are certainly many parents listening to this conversation right now. I am a parent of several children and often ask myself when I find one of my children in front of South Park or in front of Family Guy or in front of The Simpsons saying, I can see a point here that is worthy when you get through some of this stuff, but before you get there, the kids, there is a dual audience here, isn't it? The depth at which you see this is different depending on your age, probably.
You know, the first and most important thing, of course, is, you know, parents need to make these decisions for themselves, of course. And when it comes to somebody, you know, like a Cartman character, it can be very dangerous. I think it absolutely can. I think especially, you know, the way he, you know, I think a lot of people throughout America have relatively little interaction with Jewish people. people. You know, there's large swaths of this country where the Jewish population is very minimal, and yet Eric Cartman's there sort of, you know, at the very least, really stressing the point that Jews are different, that if somebody's a Jew, it's something you should point out about them. And I think if that's not balanced with other representations, with other understandings of Judaism, of Jewish people, it can be very dangerous.
You argue for a new progressive form of interpretation of the show. Is that what you've been talking about? Explain what you mean.
There's a common approach in the study of stereotypes on television, of representations on television and films, to find good and bad representations and kind of approve of them or disapprove of them. So you find a character, you look at them, you say, you know, that person represents a negative African-American stereotype. I'll mark that individual character in the bad column and say, don't watch that show. And I'll find a character, you know, Bill Cosby. He is a positive, you know, role model who happens to be African-American. I'll say that's a good representation. And part of what I'm arguing here is against that kind of perspective. On the one hand, you know, that can be very problematic when you start doing this because it's hard to take a bigger, sort of take a step back and get a better idea. For example, if you were to do this with the character of Tonto from The Lone Ranger, you might say, well, he's smart, he's loyal, he's a good, he's good at his job, and so on and so forth. I'll call him a positive character. But when you do that, you're sort of ignoring the place that that character has in broader discursive streams. You know, the way that it reinforces the subservience of the Native American and so on and so forth. So what I'm arguing is with the case of South Park, let's not just look and say, oh, he said something offensive, oh, that Jewish character is a stereotype. Let's see what it's doing in terms of a broader message that is not just stuck within that program. What kind of commentary is it making outside of the program itself? How is it interacting with other television that we're watching at a given moment? Especially, you see the way that South Park is produced. It's very, very topical. The program is produced on a much shorter schedule than any other animation out there, really. So it's able to not just, you know, be telling a story. It's able to be interacting with the nightly news. It's able to interact with the Daily Show, which is also on the same station. And let's not just look at characters, say, oh, that's a good character, that's a bad character. Let's see what kind of an interaction this discussion of anti-Semitism or this character has with the news of the day, with what else we're thinking about at a given moment.
Mm-hmm. Can the effects of a show like South Park be measured on our society? Can you see its effects?
Well, I mean, I'm not a media effects researcher, and so I can't speak to that in any great detail. I'm suspicious, and I guess my remark to that would be, it's a danger to try to isolate it. It's a danger to try to pretend that South Park is something that can be separated from the rest of our society, especially the rest of our media world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I was saying a moment ago, this show is, you know, it's embedded inside a media universe. It's in constant dialogue with it. A large percentage of the shows are directly mocking, parodying, commenting on something that, you know, the viewer is likely to at least be aware of, if not have seen on television the night before. And to try to kind of pull it out and pretend that it's something that we could remove without changing the other pieces, I think is a little bit naive. You know, I think as sort of a representative of a trend, I think we can...
Okay, then take that from the societal level down to just comedy in general. Where is it pointing us if that's a trend in comedy?
Right. Well, I mean, on the one hand, there's just the simple rule throughout the history of comedy that for something to be funny, it often has to break taboos. It often has to cross lines. And, you know, whereas not so long ago, sort of being a little bit more sexual would have crossed lines. You know, that no longer maybe has the same bite as it used to. I mean, what is sort of the taboo? What is the thing that we are afraid to talk about in America, or the thing that makes us most uncomfortable? And the answer is race and sexuality, and I think religion also.
Right, because when you watch South Park often, I often have the reaction of just cringing and saying,
right.
I do not believe they are going there.
Absolutely, and that is something that's progressive, right? That's something we sort of build a tolerance. and it would, you know, there was a time where, you know, sort of certain bodily humor was considered to be really pushing taboos. Now, you know, the fart joke is a cliche, something we don't notice even. You know, race is still something that pushes our buttons. It's still something we're afraid to talk about. And some of what's so funny about it is just the fact that they're going to say something that you don't hear anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine a time in the future, this trend continuing, that we'll sort of run out of taboos to break, that there will be no shocking new universe to move into?
That there will always be something, right? I think that people need to have something that will offend them. If you have values, then those values can be offended. I do think we'll see a time where this kind of stuff, where sort of the racial humor doesn't do anything for us. I mean, hopefully it's because we can't take it seriously. Hopefully because we get to a point where racism is anachronistic. Now, that's obviously very ideal, but, you know, hopefully something like that comes along eventually. But so long as people have values, as long as there's something that people hold dear, you know, there's going to be somebody out there who's going to make people laugh by not holding it dear, mm-hmm. by breaking it. What that would be in the future, you know, I'm not sure. I don't think it's linear. I think we could very well see you know, things turn back. I mean, I think religion sort of, you know, ebbs and flows with societies. And for example, that could definitely, again, you know, kind of become more on our minds or less.
I wonder if you divide South Park viewers into two groups, or if it's more complicated than this. Those who miss the point and they consider the humor and ethnic references vulgar, and those who get it, see it as a vehicle for delivering a larger message of reflection about our society.
I try not to do that. The real reason I try not to do that is that I don't want to discredit the viewer who doesn't see it this deeper meaning, this more progressive reading of the program. I don't want to delegitimize that reaction. I think that the reaction is 100% legitimate and 100% appropriate. And, you know, I also want to leave room in that gray area, right? People who think that there's a certain point at which, you know, the jokes are working for them both as humor and as social commentary, but some of them just cross the line. So I wouldn't want to create that kind of binary put people into separate camps. However, there probably is a continuum of people who are willing to look beyond the crassness, beyond the shock value, to find social commentary. Now, whether or not they find it there is another question, but I think it's very important to acknowledge that if one simply cannot get beyond those offensiveness of it, that they're not wrong in any sense. They're simply, you know, reacting in a way that the creators should be aware of.
Matt Shinkevich, this has been fascinating, but before we let you go, I'd like to touch on the documentary film that you co-directed. It will be screened in Cedar Falls at the UNI campus, called Live from Bethlehem, and it chronicles the struggles, the failures, the triumphs of, if I'm correctly pronouncing this, Muon News Network?
The Maan News Network.
The Maan News Network.
Yeah.
It is a... you tell us what it is.
Well, it's a 36-minute documentary. It follows the Maan News Network through its early stages. Now, the Maan News Network is the only major independent news outlet and television production outlet in the Palestinian territories. It's based in Bethlehem in the West Bank. And what the documentary does is it shows the station in its early, it's the network in its early years, and we pick up on a couple of characters, the reporters, the photographers who work for their website. We watch them work. We show the viewer what it takes to produce news in the West Bank, and mm-hmm. in a very difficult situation, not just politically, but also, you know, very unpredictable. It's very hard to produce news on a schedule if you don't know if a checkpoint will be open or closed. You can get to where the news is happening, or you know, whether or not the political situation is going to change in a moment in such a fashion that's going to make it hard for you to get on the air. So we show you how they operate, and then we also put it in context that should, I hope, really be of interest and importance to the American viewer. which is that the station is funded largely with American dollars, with money from the United States State Department. We show how that, in some ways, you know, is very positive and benefits them, but also creates a lot of difficulties.
So the takeaway from the film you hope will be?
There's two that I would like to see people take away from the film. One, I would like them to, presuming that they enter with a limited knowledge of the Palestinian territories, of Palestinians, of the West Bank, I'd like them to see a much more multidimensional picture of what it is, what life is in the West Bank, what media is in the West Bank. You know, you'll see characters who I suspect will surprise you. Amira Hanania is one of the main characters in the film. She's a 26-year-old woman. She's a radio host, an ace reporter, a documentary producer, and a mother of two twin boys. She's balancing all this, working, you know, in a really difficult situation. I don't think we get that portrayal of the Palestinian woman that much in our American news or in what we read about. And then, secondly, an understanding that America is implicated in this in a very direct sense, and that somebody like Amira, her job is dependent on your tax dollars ultimately, and that I don't want you to come away yes or no from the film, but I want you to come away having an understanding that, you know, who you vote for, who you send to Washington, has an impact far beyond what you might be aware of.
Okay. Matt Sienkiewicz, thank you very much. It's been a great discussion to learn about the work that you're involved in. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
A conversation I had yesterday with Emmy-nominated screenwriter and documentarian Matt Sienkiewicz. He will visit the University of Northern Iowa next week. UNI is hosting a series of events featuring Sienkiewicz, including a discussion on the depiction of ethnic and racial stereotyping in the South Park series. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange are now available at iowapublicradio.org. And, of course, we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime by email. Our email address is theexchange@iowapublicradio.org.